My name is Ralph White, and I'm an alcoholic. I almost didn't make it here this evening. I'm going to snitch Larry out. You know what I mean? I don't know when we made arrangements to come, but I put something on my calendar reminder. And I got back home this weekend, and on Monday morning when I went to work, I had something pop up, say San Diego. San Diego, Saturday, and a phone number. That's it. I looked in my email for the letter and nothing. So I called the number, didn't even know who the name was. Called the number, left a message, Larry calls me back. Larry says, well, yeah, you're supposed to be talking on December the 17th. Oh, okay, cool. December 17th, we'll deal with it. Then a couple of days later, he hits me back. Oh, Ralph, you are supposed to be talking Saturday, you know. And thank God I didn't have anything. And so now that I snitch you out, Larry, I want to thank you. I want to thank you. Can think of no place I would rather be than at a meeting with you guys on a Saturday night. Didn't know I was going to feel. I go to lots of meetings, and I get the opportunity to go to lots of meetings. But some stuff has happened here tonight. First off, I want to thank the 10-minute speaker. Where's the judge at? You know, I really want to thank the judge. And what I like the most about the judge, wherever he is, and then my boy that's with me said, ooh, that's a real judge we had tonight. I said, it's Halloween. It's Halloween. But wherever the judge is, you know what I like the most about the judge, and don't trip, judge. I like your message, too. But the judge had his tie. I mean, his tie is perfect right there. And I'm like, so, judge, you know, I want to get with you after the meeting so I could have that perfect tie. So I want to thank the judge. And then you guys must have a requirement at 90 days. You growing big at 90 days, huh? You guys are fattening them up, you know, for 90 days. Where the 290-day guys? I mean, big boys. You know, yeah. And I want to congratulate Bill for his 23 years. And then I'm going to talk about what it is that's got me, you know, feeling the way I'm feeling tonight. Thank the people that came out to dinner. There was a group from this group that came out and met me and my boy for dinner. And new friends in this section over here. You know, in Alcoholics Anonymous, one of the things that I found in a real meeting, in a three legacy group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and in an active group in Alcoholics Anonymous, you'll usually find members who go above and beyond the regular, I'm just going to a meeting. I like those kind of meetings. I like people who demonstrate that this is what this really is. You might have walked into this spot and you might be thinking, oh man, I done came to a corny ass place. They sing happy birthday and man, what is this place? But what it really is, and we'll talk about some things tonight. I'm going to talk about a couple of things, but what I really want to introduce you to is the AA way of life. You know, it's like nothing else I've discovered since coming here. And the AA way of life, you know, this new way of living, when you come from the dark place that I come from, you know, and the reason I'm so excited that I'm glad that I showed up, you know, I do a workshop on Sunday mornings, and I put something on the page, and just, you know, I'm going to be in San Diego. And the lady that did the third, that got up here and read from chapter 3, Maru, I know she was driving from Los Angeles. Just cause. Brother back here, Kenny, he's a member of our group, and he hasn't been hidden. He's from San Diego. He took a cake last year. He said, I don't know nobody. I feel like I'm out here all alone, and I'm on an island. And then he's been hidden and missing with us because he drives trucks, and he don't get to come. He said, I heard you were going to go down there. I'm going to go see my family, and I'm going to show up. And my boy Mark jumped in the car with a brother. This ain't just around the corner. Jumped in a car. We rode out here and we had a good time, and the 2 hours felt like about 25 minutes. My boy Derek and his wife Irina. And I'm sitting up here, you know, this ain't the Academy Award. This ain't thank you, everybody, but this is, you guys invited me. I'm talking to you about my life. See, I come from a dark place. And finally, you know, and D brought his mom out and I got to meet her. You know, he's given me the privilege of walking and opening himself up to me. And I come from the dark place. See, I'm going to do the most important thing I'm going to do now. I want to talk to you guys up over here. A couple of you sitting back there, one or two over here. I want to talk to my new friends. I know a couple of things about you already. What this dude know about me? I know this ain't been a good year for you. I know you're not coming off a winning streak. I know you're sitting up in here thinking, why do I have to be up in here on this? How did things come to this? A couple of young guys over there, you're probably thinking I might have overreacted. Might have been a little bit too hasty. Might be a drastic measure. And somebody is probably thinking I'm jittery alone, I can't do this. But you can. Just now tapped into a source of power much greater than yourself. Take this ride with us. Don't know about you. Let me share something with you. If you come from the dark place I come from, see, I come from the unneeded place, the unnecessary place, the unwanted place. I come from walking the streets at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. You might be sitting up there thinking, this dude's standing up in front of me with a tie on. You know, he's stringing these sentences together. His hair is combed, you know. How this lame going to tell me anything? I come from the dark place. I walk the aimless walk. On October the 10th of 1986, I was walking that walk. And the next day, the very next day, something happened. I went from a place where I couldn't put it down. I went from a place where, no, I'm not one of the speakers that's going to stand in front of you and say, I couldn't get sober for 30 minutes. I could get sober. That was my problem. The moments of being dry were torture for a guy like me. I came from that place, man, where all my life had been reduced to was getting it, doing it, coming down from it. Getting it, doing it, coming down from it. Getting it, doing it, coming down from it. What happened? Share a couple of things with you I believe in real strong. I believe in this fellowship. I believe in this power that you guys have introduced me to that's given me the power to say, no, thank you, I'm not drinking today. I still believe in miracles. Told you the dark place I came from, that's not where I started at. I started on 108th and Central in a little two-bedroom apartment. Moms and pops stayed in one bedroom, six boys in the other. Or earliest memory of my old man was he was an alcoholic and I didn't want to be like him. He wasn't abusive. He wasn't violent. He was an absentee drunk. And every other Friday, like clockwork, you knew my old man would not be showing up with the check. Be a kid in the neighborhood who would tell us how my old man would perform up at the pool hall. I feel ashamed and I feel embarrassed, and those are feelings I'm familiar with from a really early age. Pops got put out when I was 8 or 9. Mom started raising these six boys by herself. Don't know about you, but when I grew up, ideal family life, you took it from the TV programs. And the TV programs of the day when I was a kid, Ozzie and Harriet, Father Knows Best, My Three Sons, Leave It to Beaver. You know, that wasn't jumping off in my house. When you're grown, you get something that's called perspective. Perspective works like this. You got a mom to raise, six boys by herself. She was on welfare at the time. Old Southern Baptist sister. And my mom refused to settle for a lot. And she put herself back through high school. She put herself through college. She worked two jobs. She took in clothes that she washed and ironed for other folk. And when you're grown, you look back on your life and say, damn, I had a hell of a mom. Look how she sacrificed to raise her boys. But when you're a kid about 9 or 10 years old and you come coming home from school on a Wednesday afternoon, got a couple of partners, and mom's is in the living room with an ironing board up and a rag on her head, you don't feel proud. You feel ashamed. You feel embarrassed, and you stop bringing partners home from school. And if your name is Ralph, you start living in the prison I've lived in much of my life. And that's the prison of what I think you think about me. Don't know what you think about me, but I'm trapped in what I think you think about me, and I will do whatever it takes to shape and form and mold your opinion of Ralph. I'll wine you, I'll dine you, I'll woo you, I'll con you, I'll bully you, I'll manipulate you, I'll buy you. Please like me. Now, I don't particularly have to like your ass, but please like me. Growing up like that, you know, new friends. Go to enough meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, you'll hear some common themes from our members. And one of the common themes you hear from most of our members is, I never felt like I fit in. And that's not part of my story. I'm a little guy, I like a lot of attention. I've never been interested in fitting in. I've always wanted to stand out. As a result of that, my story includes, I achieved and I accomplished a couple of things. Every one of you had me in your classroom. I was usually class president or student body president. I was a straight A student. I was teacher's pet. I played ball. I made all-stars. On the outside, I should have been okay. On the inside, I've always felt like if you really knew me, you wouldn't like me. Yeah, I was teacher's pet. Yeah, I was straight A student. Would have traded it all in if I could have been cool. If I just could have been cool. Because in my neighborhood, it was a whole lot more currency placed on cool than on smart. A couple of cats in here, I see you. The ones who was cool. You know, you was the ones in the bathroom, smoking cigarettes, shooting dice, taking quarters from guys like me that brought extra quarters with them. And you knew how to talk to, you knew how to talk to girls, and girls were a mystery to me. You know, I don't know why, fellas, you guys always had a handle on this manhood thing early. And I just didn't seem to have it. You know, 13 years old, cats were talking about throwing down with girls already. I didn't know you were lying, but I'd be thinking to myself, damn, how come I don't know what time it is? Later on, I always ran with a crew. And then in my crew, it would always be a pretty boy. It would always be a player, right, in my crew. And when I was clubbing, right, in life, I'd be in the club, and I'd be hanging with my boy that's the pretty boy, and I want to ear hustle, right? I want to know what he's saying to make a girl giggle, right, because I didn't know how to make a girl giggle. It took me a while to get comfortable telling my story in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, this is the first place I ever landed where folk try to out-bottom each other, right? I wanted a penitentiary story without going to the pen to get it. But my story is my story. Not willing to go with another. You heard the judge, and he a judge too, right? And he was talking about drinking when he was 6 years old. I'm 8 years old. You know, I ain't touched nothing. I'm 16. That's late in alcohol. I ain't done nothing. You know, I get a girlfriend at 16. Now, Ralph with a girlfriend at 16 don't mean the same thing it means for the rest of you cats. Ralph with a girlfriend at 16 simply means this. I ran with a crew of dudes, went with the same group of girls. One of my boys broke up with this girl. I waited a little time to pass, told my other boy, look, I want to go with her. He came back and told me, she said, yes, now I got a girlfriend, right? Don't know what to do with her, you know. I had had other girlfriends before, but this one actually knew she was my girlfriend, right? This particular night, I go out on a double date. Older partner of mine, he in the front seat, him and his girl in the front seat. Me and my girl in the back seat, right? Plastic cup of rum and coke come to the back seat this particular night, drink it down real warm, rush back to the top of my brain. All of a sudden, Ralph's hands started doing things they had never done. Mouth started saying things it had never said. I'd arrived. Alcohol did for me what I couldn't do for myself, gave me the courage to do and to be and to say things I wouldn't do, be, and say without it, and I liked it. I liked it a lot. The Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous talks about me in lots of places. New friends, we have a chapter in the front of our book called The Doctor's Opinion, and in The Doctor's Opinion, there's a line that jumped out at me first time I read it. Men and women like me drink essentially for the effect produced by alcohol. Recognize that first time I read it. I'm not overnight alcoholic. I've heard people share all over the show, and I've heard people share that their first drink, it was mystical, it was magical, it was transformative. They'll never forget it. You know, they made a vow they'll drink for the rest of their life. You know, all that. None of that happened for me. I understand this disease being progressive in nature because that's how it showed up in my experience. First time I drank, I didn't get pissy drunk. I didn't throw up all over myself. I didn't make a fool out of myself. I got a warm, tipsy feeling, a kiss and licked and sucked on my girl in some places I had never done before, and that's how my drinking stayed. I would drink to go out on the weekends and party. Graduated from high school in 71, graduated to higher education in every sense of the word. 71, I'm still just drinking on the weekends when I'm partying. By the end of 71, I'm drinking not only the night of the weekend, but I'm drinking during the day to get ready for the party. By 1972, I'm drinking not only on the weekends, but I'm drinking after class during the week, and I've added some non-addictive marijuana to the mix. By the end of 72, I'm drinking, and I'm smoking herb, and I'm selling selling herb. By 1973, I'm drinking, I'm smoking herb, I'm selling herb, I'm doing other drugs, doing it on a daily basis. Could not have told me it was anything wrong with the way I was living. The big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, talks about at a certain point in my drinking career, I won't be able to tell the truth from the false. And the way that worked for me was this. Isn't the way that I'm doing it, isn't that the way everybody does it? Why would you be young, with a bright future, with a little bit of money, then chasing women and getting loaded, come with the territory? In those days, man, if you came over my house and I couldn't offer you something to drink or something to smoke, I wasn't being a good host. And if I went over your house and you didn't do the same for me, not only weren't you being a good host, wasn't coming over your house no more. For what? Have nothing to talk about. You know, in 2016, no disrespect to our young friends. I don't mean new friends. I mean our young friends. I'm glad I grew up at the time I grew up. I'm glad I grew up in the era I grew up. I came up in a time in this country, I came up in a time and a place, you go to concerts, you don't even have to know your neighbor, you just pass and stuff. You know, and I came up at a time, you know, in 2016, you got to practice safe sex, or you got deadly sexually transmitted diseases, man, you got the rest. And even though in the late 60s and the early 70s, it was a changing time and a turbulent time in this country, in some ways it seemed like a simpler time. Back in those days, I'd go to a club, I'd have a one-question interview for a girl. You get high? If not, next. I don't need to know your sign. I don't want to know your last name. I don't need to know who your mommy is. Let's get to the basis of this relationship. Are you getting down like I'm getting down? That's just the way it was. I'm at this major university, man, and I'm rolling with the people in the way I think that, you know, I'm at this major university. I came to the program. I'm going to bounce around for a minute now. I came to the program four times before I came to stay. You know, we were at dinner and Larry talked about coming in, and I came four times before I came to stay. New friends, there's some thin lines in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. You'll hear them discussed from time to time in meetings. And one of the thinnest lines that makes most of the difference is a thin line between comparing and identifying. And in my early attempts at Alcoholics Anonymous, I would always compare and I would never identify. And I couldn't find myself in the big book Alcoholics Anonymous, and I couldn't find myself in any of you guys' stories. I would read the big book Alcoholics Anonymous, I'd read Bill's story. First thing I say when I read his story, Bill is an older white guy. Psh, you know we ain't got that in common. You know, Bill was he's a veteran of foreign wars. I'm a Vietnam-era draft dodger. Bill is a Wall Street stockbroker. Check out the way I handle money. We ain't got that in common. You read Bill's story, Bill said there had been no real infidelity. Miss me on that one, too. You know, so I read all the differences. I do the same thing when you guys got up here and shared your stories. I listen for all the differences. And when I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous to stay, somebody taught me how to read the big book Alcoholics Anonymous. And they said, Ralph, the same way that you read the big book Alcoholics Anonymous is the same way you listen to our members share their experience, strength, and hope at the meetings. When you read the big book Alcoholics Anonymous and when you listen to our members share their stories, ask yourself three or four questions. Ask yourself, did I drink like he drank? Did I think like he thought? Did I feel like he felt? Or did I do what he did? And when I read Bill's story in the light of those questions, I found my story. 1971, I'm at this major university, and just like Bill, the drive for success was on. I proved to the world I was important. Just like him, drink started taking a more important and exhilarating part in my life. He said something strange in his story. He said, out of this alloy of drink and speculation, I would out of a this combination of his thinking and his drinking, he would later forge a weapon that would turn on him like a boomerang and all but cut him to ribbons. I don't talk like that. Folk I know had a shortcut version. They just used to always say, trouble always starts out like fun. And when I was in the dorms drinking that Red Mountain, drinking that Spinata, drinking that Annie Greenspring, drinking that Boone's Farm, you know what youngsters drinking, you know, drinking, now I'm drinking that Brass Monkey and the Southern Comfort and all. Man, you couldn't have told me it was going to have its way with me the way it did. Staggered up out that school some kind of way, started working as a counselor for LA City Schools. Although I had the kind of job that should have allowed me to acquire what normal people acquire, I never did. That snapshot of Ralph's life, this is when alcohol was working. I'd buy a car, I'd make exactly 3 car payments, then come find it. First time I had a car repossessed, I had the nerve to call LAPD. 9 months behind on the note, right? You know, I'm calling. I want to report a stolen car. They do whatever they do. Mr. White, the rightful owner, just came and picked up their stuff. Next 2 times, I didn't even trip. I already knew. I'm the kind of brother, never had a problem balancing a bank book. Payday, I got money. 2 days later, broke. 0. No problem balancing my bank book. Stayed in the crib from 1976 to 1978 without paying rent. couple of baffling features about the disease I suffer from. One of them is this. I can't see my relationship with alcohol until I'm free of it. I can't see what it's doing to me when I'm in the mix. So some of the things that are crystal clear to me now, looking back in the rearview mirror of experience, were not at all clear to me when I was going through them. One fact stands out real clear to me about the days I thought alcohol was working. I used to go to work for 2 weeks to live for 2 days. That's it. That's all. Can't tell you the day or the time or the hour. Can't tell you where I was or what I was doing when alcohol ceased to be a luxury for me, but I can tell you that it did happen. You know what I don't like about the invisible line? Somebody should. It's invisible. It ain't nothing to say if you take this next one, you enter in the region from which there's no return to. Matter of fact, by the time you realize there's a line down there, you way over here. Who put that line there? You know what I'm saying? You know, cold thing about the disease I suffer from is this. By the time I realize I have a problem and need to do something about it, it's already too late for me to do something about it. Cold thing. Anybody else in here play a regret game in Alcoholics Anonymous? You know how the regret game go? If I only knew then what I know now, I never would. Yeah, right. Remind me of a story I like to tell about a little boy named Johnny. Johnny had a habit his father frowned on. Johnny used to like to play with himself. Father goes to work one day, comes home early. Little Johnny's bedroom door is closed. Father opens the door without knocking. Little Johnny's in the bedroom masturbating. Father looks at him and says, "Son, I thought I told you if you keep doing that, you'll go blind." Little Johnny looked at his dad and said, "Well, Daddy, can I just do it till I need glasses?" You know, and I like that story. I like that story because that story reminds me of me and the life. I see you going down, you going down, you going, "I'm just going to do it today." And the book talks about seeking the Lord companion. It wasn't long before I became the Lord companion. We don't have enough time. Got married on a Saturday afternoon in April of 1980. I had a bachelor party the night before my wedding. None of the guys at the bachelor party are getting married the next day. They all got sense enough to go home at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. I'm still at my bachelor, right? Me and my brother still 7:30 in the morning. Get me on. They pick me up at 7:30, take me home at 7:30, put me in the bed, get me up at 10 o'clock for my 1 o'clock wedding. I'm tore up. I'm tore up. Nothing left to throw up but stomach lining like that, you know, bed rotation. I'm tore up. I'm supposed to say my own vows at this wedding. So I show up at the wedding, and I'm stumbling, and I'm staggering. And my then wife-to-be took one look at the stagger, and she looked at the preacher, and she said, "Okay, priest, you know, scratch the own vow. Say the regular on his ass, right?" So now, getting to the ceremony, it gets to me. I get ready to say, and threw up all over. Passed out. Have not taken a wedding picture to this day. Pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. New friends, if you're anything like me, when I hit the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, although the words that they use in the room were not unfamiliar to me, the way that they use them is not the way I use them in my everyday walk around vocabulary. I needed some help. We're talking about this psychic change and this phenomena of craving and this allergy of the body. And the way you guys talked about them was not familiar to me. I needed some old timers to get with me. But the first time I heard pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, didn't need no help with that one. Folk like us don't need a dictionary for pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. I lived pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization up close and personal, and I lived it over and over and over and over again. See, I'm the kind of father and I'm the kind of husband. Remember sitting on my living room couch. Wife coming out the bathroom real fast, pulling her pants up. Go to the dining room table, pick her purse up, clutch it real close as she went back to the bathroom. Feel as tall because nobody was in the house but me and her, but it got like that in my house. The kind of father, and I'm the kind of husband, remember coming home, sticking my key in the door. Wife and 2-year-old daughter sitting here, and they're both crying. I look over here, and homeboy sitting in my seat with a gun pointed at my stomach talking about I want my money right now. Fellas, I don't know about the rest of you guys, but I always had a lot of fears and a lot of doubts about, do I have what it takes to be a father? do I have what it takes to be a husband? Because if you're in the life, the track record already gives you your answer, right? Because what's the father's role and what's the husband's role? To protect and to provide, and it's a cold-blooded feeling, fellas. Laying in bed with a woman night after night after night after night. Knowing not only aren't you protecting, knowing not only aren't you providing, you the one bringing the wolf to the door. See, I'm the kind of father and I'm the kind of husband. Remember sitting on my back porch, two-year-old daughter coming outside, pulling in my coat. Daddy, daddy, that's my piggy bank. Remember stopping and giving her a little grin. Don't worry, baby. Daddy's going to put some dollar bills in here for this change. And I wasn't raised to be stealing from my daughter. I wasn't raised to be stealing from my wife. I was an alcoholic with no tools of recovery, and I did what it took to get what I needed to get. Share with you that my disease is progressive in nature, and in my experience is progressive in a couple of areas. Share one area already. It takes more than it used to take in order for me to get the same effect. But my disease is progressive in another area, my behavior. My behavior gets progressively worse. I'm willing to do more readily, chase this thing. First time I had my wife's purse, if you would hook me up to a poly, I would have passed when I said, I'm not stealing this $40. I'm going to take this $40, and I'm going to replace it before she knows it's missing. I meant it, because I don't steal. Took that $40, went out, spent it up, came back looking for some more money, looked for the purse, she had moved it. I didn't look for the purse because I couldn't believe I had hit it like that. I said, I'm going to replace this money before she knows it's missing. When we were at dinner, Celeste was talking, and she said, I want to go to Founders Day. I want to go where this deal started. Every now and then, I like to reflect on when this deal started, how fragile the ties are that hold us in this room together right now, this close, and we wouldn't be here. Kat was in a hospital in 1934 in December, fourth time, same hospital. A friend of his had visited him the previous month. He was a member of a group. He was sober. This dude had been trying to stay sober, couldn't stay sober. Doctor told his wife, get a black dress. Your insurance paid. And something happened to Bill Wilson in that hospital in December of 1934. And what happened was so remarkable, he thought he was losing his mind. He went to the doctor the next day, called the doctor, and he told the doctor what had happened, described it. Here's the thing. Doctor, it didn't happen to the doctor, and the doctor ain't one of us, but it was so powerful and it was so profound, and the power of the power was such that the doctor from the outside looking in told him, dude, I don't know what happened to you, but you would look good holding on to it. And Bill Wilson left that hospital that December of 1934, and he set about looking for people like me and you. And in about 6 months' time, nobody stayed sober. Nobody stayed sober, but he did. Some of his boys put together a business proposition, and they sent him out to represent their interests in Akron, Ohio. And he went out there, and his business didn't come off too well. And he found himself in a hotel lobby on a Saturday afternoon, and he got thirsty on that Saturday in that hotel lobby. He had about $10 in his pocket. Do I pay for my room, or do I get a drink? Thought came to him. Strange thought. I ain't never had a thought like that. I had a similar thought. He said, I need to find a drunk. Had plenty of thoughts like that. He said, not to drink. I ain't never had a thought like that. Here's the cold thing. Get a drink or find a drunk. He said, yes to the idea of finding a drunk. He said, yes to the idea of finding a drunk to work with. No sponsor. No meetings. No 12 steps. No closed mouth friend, no writing. He found a drunk to work with when he felt thirsty. It's still what we do. It's the reason we're sitting in here tonight. We do a lot of other stuff, but it's something we do that we do. We talk to each other. And through a series of divine coincidences, he got put in touch with a lady who had a husband like us. And Bill Wilson talked to Ann Smith and said, I understand your husband got a drinking problem. I'd like to talk to him. Dr. Bob was passed out. Came to, said, okay. Next day, he said, I'm going to give dude 15 minutes. They met the next day, and that 15 minutes turned into about 5 hours. And those two gentlemen set about looking for people like me and you. In about 2 years' time, about 40 people were staying sober. Imagine that. Look how many people were in here. But at that time, wasn't nobody sober. About 40 people were staying sober. I like to think that New York hustler must have looked at the Akron physician. Might have said something like this: how are we going to let Ralph White know when it's his turn? And they said, we'll put it in a book. And they put me in that book. When you get introduced to that book, now that book is not the treasure, it's the map. For those of you thumpers that are in the room right now, the book ain't the treasure, it's the map. There's a power that did something for me on October the 11th that changed me from who I was October the 10th. No steps, no sponsor, not you guys. There's a power that changed this man from October the 10th on October the 11th to this day. He ain't had one. But there's a roadmap. Put me in that book. 2 weeks after I said I'm going to replace this money before she knows it's missing, I'm out doing the same thing. Same scenario presents. I'm out. I spend up all my money, right? And the idea of replacing the money didn't even come to mind. There's a line in the book that says something like this: we don't know why, but the alcoholic can be unable to recall with sufficient force. Pain, suffering, humiliation, weeks, even days ago. I couldn't even remember. It got replaced by a new thought. I said, last time I took 40 and came back looking for the rest of the money, and she had moved the purse. This time I'll take all the money out the purse, and that I don't spend up, I'll sneak it back in the purse. Off and running in my wife's purse on a regular. I did that one too many times. Came back one morning, screen door was locked. Note was on the screen door: rest of your stuff is at your mama's house. Suitcase on the porch. I'm put out my house. I'm now my daddy. Over the course of the next year, my five brothers got put out their respective homes. All of us ended up in my mom's house, and we damn near killed her. When I got put out of my house and went to stay at my mom's house, my ex-wife thought it was something salvageable about this piece of man she married. She used to bring my daughter over on Saturday so we could keep a father-daughter relationship, and I wanted to be a father to my little girl with everything in me. I really, really, really did. I wanted to take my girl to Disneyland. I wanted to take her to Magic Mountain. I wanted to take her to a movie on a Saturday afternoon. I wanted to walk up the street with her little hand in my big hand, just take her to the store and buy her some ice cream. I wanted to sit my little girl in my lap and read stories to her. I wanted to tuck her in bed at night and get a good night kiss. I wanted to get the look from my little girl that I've seen men in the fellowship get, the look like, this is my daddy and this is my hero. And the best I could do on those Saturdays was 30 minutes. 30 minutes. Tell my mom something like, I'm going to the store to buy Rain some ice cream. Disappear. Show back up on Sunday night when her mom was coming to get her. Still remember some of them long Sundays, sticking my head around the side of my mom's house. Tears flowing. Tears flowing. Still remember through the tears, I see them two heads in the car and those headlights backing out the driveway. And I'd be thinking to myself, there goes my life, backing out this driveway. And I've heard a lot of people share they were scared of dying out there. Not my story. Never scared of dying, scared I was going to keep waking up to the same old thing. Monday the same as Tuesday, the same as Sunday, the same as Christmas, over and over and over again. And I'm so glad God don't make misery comfortable. And on October the 11th, 1986, I got miserable enough, I got tired enough, I got directed to my fourth program of recovery. I went to the Harbor Light Center on Skid Row in downtown Los Angeles. 2 days after they brought in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. That October of 1986, I was in a real dark place. I was in a real bad way. I had not looked at myself full face in the mirror in over a year. I was full of remorse and I was full of regret. And I was full of, I'd never be able to forgive myself for the things I had done and what I had become. Took me to that meeting and a speaker was standing in front of the group somewhat like I am tonight. And he was sharing about taking from the job, and he was sharing about taking from the family. And I remember looking at him and thinking to myself, yeah, you sharing about doing scandalous things, but you look scandalous. You should have been doing that. I'm different. Y'all ain't going to hear my business. Speaker seemed like he knew I was in the room, dropped something on me like this. Said, if you're sitting in this room right now, you are not responsible for your disease, but you are responsible for your recovery. And you have just now tapped into a source of power much greater than yourself. And you don't have to drink, and you don't have to use, no matter what, provided you are willing to fulfill some conditions. And that speaker that night caught my attention. He went on to say, this is the only club you can be a member of where the worse off you are when you get here, the better off your chances of staying. And I got the message of hope from the first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous I went to. I was 33 years old that October 1986. Sometimes it seems like a story that I tell when I get to tell my story. I get to share a lot. I get to go a lot of places. I get to meet a lot of you guys. And every now and then, I get to feel it. I'm a couple of weeks past exactly 30 years ago. When I was in that dark place. It's 33 years old and I had given up on life. The book describes me in so many places. I'm the alcoholic that the book describes as the real Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Our stories disclose in a general way. We can't fill in all the blanks. We don't have enough time. But somehow in the midst of my drinking and in the midst of my using, in my career, I was ascending. In 1985, I had ascended to a place. I was working in management in a major utility company in their law department. I was supervising about 80 people. And the thing about that kind of job is I'm business guy by day and I'm vampire by night. You know, and the cold thing about that, the business guy, the vampire always outgrows the businessman. The vampire always outgrows the housewife. The vampire always outgrows the teacher. The vampire always outgrows the church lady. The vampire started showing up at work, and they didn't pay the vampire to come to work, and the vampire didn't work at work, you know. So one day they told the vampire, you got to go and take dude with you. And I had lost my dream job. I was in management. I was finally in a salary position. And that October 1986, I was full of guys like me don't get second chances. I had lost a dream marriage. I had lost my house. I had lost everything near and dear to me. You know, wasn't welcome at my mama's house. You know, and I lost a couple of other things most of us lose by the time we reach a room like this. I lost the power of choice over whether or not I'd be doing it. And that second part, and I didn't care no more, and it scared me to death. So that October in 1986, I was 33 years old, and I was a broke young man. I'm not tonight's speaker because I'm the one that's going to try to scare you into recovery. That's not my message. I'm not the one that's going to tell you if you go back out there still kicking that. That's not my message, you know. I'm not. In fact, when what I used to think of as my heyday, people used to see the way I got down and be like, damn, Ralph, ain't you scared of overdose? And I'd be like, scared of overdose? I'm scared of the deadly underdose. You better put some more up on here. So the message of fear is not the message of the whole alcoholic of my variety. The book talks about a message that's got to have depth and that's got to have weight. The message tonight's speaker brings to you that's got the most depth and the most weight. You're looking at a guy who at 33 years old had given up on life. You're looking at a guy who at 33 years old had not answered anybody's 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock wake-up call to go to work in so long, I no longer thought I was employable. You're looking at a guy who didn't know where his little girl was living and didn't know where his family was living, didn't know where his little girl was going to school. You're looking at a guy who... 33 years old, graduate of a major university in this country, and my job at the end was taking the trash out for a 21-year-old. I was sleeping in the back of my mother's garage, and I was eating lemons off a neighbor's lemon tree for breakfast. And the men and women in this fellowship nursed me back to health. You gave me a way out upon which we could all agree. And I started doing the damn thing, man. I started going to meetings. If I have any gifts in this program of ours, you know, one of them is I've always loved meetings. It's a blind spot I have in sponsorship. It's hard for me to wrap my head around people who don't like going to meetings. And I have to realize that's me. Because that's not something that I came in here and developed. I've always liked you guys. It's always come easy for me. I like a fellowship where people say God and shit in the same sentence. That works for me, you know. I'm not a thee and thou guy, you know. When you talk about putting feet on a spiritual path to really go somewhere, I need to get down just like that. It's always been comfortable. I love reading. I love books. I love you. You can't find better stories than the stories we tell in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I love that from the beginning. So I started going to meetings. I started going to meetings. I want you to put four things in your simple kit of spiritual tools over here. This crew right here. First thing to put in your simple kit of spiritual tools, you won't find it in the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous, get a sobriety day. If you ain't got one, you don't have one. If I walk up to any of you guys and say, what's your date? And you say, you ain't got one. Get a sobriety date. Nurture it, polish it, you know, cherish it, protect it, respect it, grow it. Get a sobriety date. Then get a home group. If you ain't got one, this look like a good place to start. A home group is something like a Cheers bar, somewhere you go where everybody know your name, you know. Get a home group. Get a sponsor. You know, they put a lot of requirements on newcomers now. Try to give them a lot of interviewing skills and tools. Get a sponsor who has a sponsor who has working under you. Get a sponsor. You may not even stick with that spot. Check this out, old-timers and people in here that work with people. Get a sponsor. There's power in the conversation. There's power in that transaction. There's power in just coming up to somebody and saying, help me. Because we know who you are when you come up in here. I see some of the guys up in here now. You know, you be fighting to laugh. When you be, I don't see nothing funny. I used to sit up in there, man, I'm, you know, and sitting like this. I'm a grown-ass man. And you know, I'm a grown-ass man. You can't tell me nothing. I know. That's why you up in here. Get a sponsor. There's power in the conversation. You know, then get a road dog. Road dog is something different than your sponsor. You know. Your sponsor ain't going to be running with you. Your sponsor ain't going to be hanging out with you, you know. Plus, you're going to be coming to your sponsor. You ain't going to always be coming. No, sir, I'm not looking at girls at the meeting. You know, you come like that to your sponsor. And with your road dog, you be, man, did you see them honeys at the meeting? We going back to that meeting, you know. And that's who you talk about your sponsor to. Get a road dog. What is this speaker talking about? Man, make this thing. I was on a panel with a guy. He had 55 years of recovery. And somebody asked on the Q&A, they said, Tom, what's the most important thing you found in your recovery? And he said one word. He said enthusiasm. Enthusiasm. If it's supposed to be a program of attraction, goddammit, make it attractive. No me standing up here, that ain't no easy or something. If this thing wasn't fun, you'd have a different speaker up here. I'm dead serious about recovery, but I'm seldom serious in recovery. If you ain't laughing in this program, you ain't taking this program serious enough. I've had a lot of things happen to me on this 30-year journey, but the most important thing, man, is I'm in the game. Check this out. Everybody up in here, all of us, the minute you walk in here, we have a really inclusive third tradition. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. So everybody in the meeting, everybody we see all the time is on the team. But big boys, everybody ain't in the game. Get in the game. For those of you that ain't in the game, I ain't knocking it. I ain't tripping. We need fans. We need spectators. We need bench warmers. We even need haters. And sometimes we have analysts. They'll come up and tell you about the game. But I want to be a player. Put me in the game. Since October 11, 1986, I've been in the game. I don't care what happened. I done lost a house in front of everybody in sobriety. I done lost a 20-year marriage in front of everybody in sobriety. I done went stone broke in front of everybody in sobriety. I have never yet regretted the day that I came in, October 11, 1986, and I came in from the cold, and I came in from the dark place, and I came in from the aimless place, and I came in from the no purpose place. I got on my knees with about 18 months of recovery, and I got on my knees with a group of men and women, and I said, God, I offer myself to you. Do something with me. And he did something with me. Still hoeing, still lying, still tricking, still doing all that. You don't have to come right to get right in Alcoholics Anonymous. I got on my knees right then. I said, put me in the game. And he did something with me. I got a 34-year-old daughter. She's right now 34. She's the one I was going in the piggy bank. On January 11, 2 years ago, I walked down the aisle and I had that little girl on my from the piggy bank. And I walked down the aisle with her and the music was playing and she was shaking on my arm. And she said, Dad, this is the happiest day of my life. I'm sad about one thing. I said, what's that, baby? She said, this is the last day I'll ever be Rain White, but I'll always be Daddy's girl. I'm in the game. You know, I'm in the game. I just came back from Boston last weekend, man. I got a 21-year-old daughter. She's a senior at Boston University. She's never seen her daddy loaded, and one day at a time, she never will. And we went and we stayed at her crib, and I still remember. It took me back to when we moved her in 2 years ago, and we were moving every now and then. I want you to have your moments. I want you to have your moments. When grace comes calling, you'll be able to recognize it and call it by name. I was moving her in, and I had to take a bathroom break. You know, the other two, she had two roommates, and their parents were moving them. But what we do, it's mundane stuff that the world be doing. But for us, when we do it, I had to go to the bathroom, and I'm crying. I ain't a crying man, but I'm a crying man. I'm crying in the bathroom because it just came over me. This is what dads do. They move their little girls into their first. They don't go in the piggy bank. How many people in here sponsor people? Isn't it one of the greatest joys that you can have to see the lights come on for somebody? To see a new person come in with no lights on and they vacant in the room, and you see them light up and you see them blossom and you see them bloom. And there's some other lights that we light up every time we go to a meeting. We don't see those lights. But every time I go to a meeting, we're doing it right now. I get to participate in some little boy or some little girl getting ready to have mama come back. Every time I go to a meeting, we're doing it right now. I get to participate in some family getting ready to have daddy come home. Every time I go to a meeting, we're doing it right now. I get to participate in some man or some woman getting ready to have a hell of a mate in their life. We're doing it right now. Every time I go to a meeting, I get to participate in some employer that I don't know and could care less about getting ready to have a hell of an employee enter the workplace. Every time I go to a meeting, who wouldn't want to be part of a fellowship like that? I've always wanted to do something significant. I've always wanted to do something important. I can think of nothing more significant, and I can think of nothing more important than being a participating member of the life-saving, life-changing experience that is Alcoholics Anonymous. Whenever anybody, anywhere, if they help out, we want the hand of AA to be there always, and for that I'm responsible. I take it real serious. You'll never hear Ralph White say, "I don't know why I'm sober." I know exactly why I'm sober. I get a blessing so that I can be a blessing. Recovery for me is a gift from God. What I do with my recovery is my gift to God. My name is Ralph White. I am an alcoholic.